You're listening to Amphibicast.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Amphibicast, the original amphibian-focused podcast. And before I get into tonight's episode, I just wanted to cover a couple of things. Number one, I want to thank the Call of Nature podcast out of the UK. We'd had some kind of on and off stun on Instagram. Great bunch of people, and they'd shown support of me, and I'd like to recommend to my listeners that you go check them out. It's sort of a broad nature-based podcast. Anyone who likes to go for walks and talks about their experiences, etc., things like that. They get into some, native birds, mammals, amphibians to a small extent, insects, etc., things like that. So if you're over in the UK, check them out. If you're here in the US, if you are in South America, we've got some new listeners in South America. I want to thank you guys for being a part of it and taking an interest in the show. And in addition, I wanted to just let everyone know that I'm going to be making some improvements in terms of my equipment. Now, the podcast is continuing to do well, so I'm going to invest some time and some money into improving that experience for my listeners by investing in some better quality equipment. So, you know, for the time being, just bear with me. And as soon as I can get my hands on a little bit more quality equipment, I want the direction of the show to go, you know, where the order quality is as best as it possibly can be. Now, the one caveat to that is that, unfortunately, during the pandemic, a lot of people started making podcasts, a lot. And a lot of that equipment is either on back order or is extremely difficult to get, or there's only just, a lot of times Amazon will sell like counterfeits of name brand stuff, and it's not always of the best quality. So it's a little bit, the well kind of ran dry. So, like I said, nonetheless, I'm going to go in that direction and try to make it an even better experience for everyone who's already enjoying the show. So let's get into it. Now, tonight, my guest is Julio Rodriguez. He is one of the organizers of American Frog Day. Now, unfortunately, American Frog Day, it was going to originally be close to my home, was going to be in, I think it was Staten Island this year, but it had to be canceled due to COVID concerns. So we're hoping for next year. If you've ever gotten the opportunity to go to Frog Day, it's a very great experience. There are obviously vendors and whatnot, but there's also a lot of speakers on a variety of topics. And some of those topics, Julio and I are going to get into tonight. We're going to address some issues with conservation, some concerns, and a couple of different topics as they relate to Ulfaga lemani, which is a species of concern for a number of reasons. So we had a great time talking, and I hope you guys enjoy it. So check it out. So Julio, what's up? Thanks for joining me.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good, good. Why don't we get into it? Why don't you tell us your story? How did you get interested in amphibians, and what ultimately led that into your involvement in the dark frog world?
So my involvement into the dark frogs and amphibians was actually when I was a kid. I was about 10 years old. I always wanted to keep dart frogs. And the main thing that attracted me to dart frogs was always, you know, the coloration. So the three things I always kept were day geckos, dart frogs, and chameleons, old world chameleons. So, and then it just kind of channeled, basically, when I got to high school, I got an internship at the Bronx Zoo's Reptile House. Through my high school biology professor, and then I kind of stayed on for a couple of years and was working there. And so the amphibian care for me just kind of took priority there, as far as care and learning a lot more from the staff over at the Bronx Zoo at the time, and being able to care for them a lot easier than most people would know, because back then there was very little information back in the late 80s, and early 90s, there was just not much information that you can get out of there, from people that were keeping them. And then back in 95, actually, was the first Frog Day that was established by Chuck Powell out in California. And, my dad actually got me a ticket. And just told me, hey, tell your mom you're going camping. Just be back on Sunday.
That's a long camping trip.
Yeah. So, and then, So I went out there, and it was only about four or five vendors, and that was it, you know. And back then, you can count the number of people that were breeding frogs in just one hand as far as big breeders. You know, you had Todd Kelly, Tord Limbo, you know, Aaron from Aaron's Frog Farms, and you had Ryan Gagliardo from the Boa Barn, you know, and so it was just a handful of people, and all the communication was done through email on Frognet, which is actually still around today, believe it or not. And we also had the American Dendro Baby group, which is actually a newsletter that would come out every month for, or it would come out quarterly, started out coming out quarterly, and then, you know, it would come out, and then the membership grew, it grew to monthly subscriptions of newsletters that were mailed to you. So
cool. Now, when you were at the Bronx Zoo, was there a certain person there that mentored you?
There were several people. I had Frank, can't remember his name now. I'm friends with him on Facebook, and he's actually still involved with amphibian conservation. I run into him every once in a while at one of the reptile shows over in White Plains. And he was the main amphibian guy at the Bronx Zoo at the time. So he taught me a lot of his main thing was salamanders, but he knew just about everything as far as the dart frogs, how to care for them, and things like that. And then there was John Baylor, who happened to be the curator of the Bronx Zoo at the time, but he would always be at the reptile house. And, you know, his main thing was tortoises, but, you know, I got to work with tortoises as well, some endangered species there. And because of him, you know, like I keep tortoises today. You know, unfortunately he passed away, about 10 years ago or so. And then, you know, but yeah, those two people mainly were the big mentors there for me.
Now, I mean, at this time in history, would you say that dart frogs in scientific collections and zoos were kind of concurrent with like dart frogs coming into the hobby? I mean, did the two kind of happen simultaneously?
I think more zoos were keeping them back then than people were. So, I mean, the National Aquarium in Baltimore was always known as the vault, or the place that had the biggest collection of dart frogs in the U.S. Back in the 90s. So, I mean, if you ever got to see that collection behind the scenes, I mean, they had Lamanis there. You know, they had the only wild-caught Azurias, you know, that you've ever seen. And, you know, if you ever got a chance to see wild-caught Azurias compared to the Azurias that are in the hobby today, I mean, you're talking about, you know, they're probably about twice the size as far as how big they were. Yeah, you know, so
that's cool. I've been to the Baltimore Aquarium. I had I had family down there. I had an aunt and uncle. I kind of went back and forth, you know, living there on and off over the past, you know, well, the first 20 years of my life. And the National Aquarium is beautiful. I love the glass. It's not really a pyramid, but it's sort of like a pyramid at the top, and there's a whole rainforest up there. And
the rainforest exhibit. Yeah,
great. With the three-toed sloth. That was my favorite. You went there and you see the three-toed sloth, and it was like, okay, I'm happy now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a really like revolutionary exhibit, because I've been to the Bronx Zoo many times when I was a kid, but seeing that, you know, the National Aquarium was just like, it was like a whole other level, especially since it was almost all vertical. So as you progress through the aquarium, you're almost going from like the ground all the way up to the top, rather than it being like as spread out as it was at the Bronx Zoo.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, obviously, Frog Day is canceled this year due to COVID, but, you know, we touched kind of briefly on how it sort of developed. But I mean, are there some highlights from previous Frog Days that you kind of want to maybe share with the audience?
I mean, every year we try to, we pick a different organization or a different cause for amphibian conservation. You know, where all the money that's raised from that particular Frog Day goes towards that cause. You know, so last year we did Mantella Kawani Assessment Project, which is being led by Devin. And then there's, you know, we raised money in the past for Tesoros in years past. We've also done the Costa Rican amphibian research pass. This year we were hoping to do EVAC with Panama for, you know, the Golden Atalopus conservation project. So that's going to be pushed back till next year. And even the local meetings that we used to have here in New York City, every meeting we always had a conservation auction, and that conservation auction went towards a cause. So we would always donate money to the Costa Rican Amphibian Research Center, and it would rotate, you know, between the different organizations. So it wasn't always going towards the same organization every single meeting. And the past couple of meetings we had, we've been having it over at the Prospect Park Zoo, but we haven't had one since quite a while. Yeah, so whenever we have a meeting at the zoo, all the funds that we raise from that particular meeting for the Prospect Park Zoo goes towards the Prospect Park Zoo, so they can build other exhibits, you know, and improve their exhibits for the animals there.
Yeah, Prospect Park, that's the one zoo in New York City that I don't think I've been to. I've been to
that's Central, a nice zoo.
Yeah, I've been to Central Park. Queens, the one in Queens is a little bit more like native species.
Yeah.
It's kind of small. I mean, it's a nice place. I guess, you know, you want to take like the kids out there for the day, but I've never been to Prospect Park.
Yeah, it has a good mixture of native species and exotic species as well. But it's a great zoo for kids, you know, so they have a lot of animals that are great for kids, you know, to see. So yeah, check it out. Definitely check it out whenever you get a chance.
Yeah, I will. I mean, now that, you know, things are starting to kind of like lighten up a little bit here in New York. I mean, you're from New York the same as I am. So
yeah,
things got kind of out of control kind of fast.
Well, the good thing about the zoos now is everything has to be by appointment only. So you're not just going to be able to walk up to the zoo and be like, can I have a ticket? So
yeah. That's funny because we have a membership that we've had for quite some time, probably going on 10 years, and nobody say anything, but my membership kind of got grandfathered in. So we still get a lot of the benefits that they don't offer with memberships now. But yeah, just like you said, like we were looking to go, but you have to make an appointment.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to make an appointment on like a Saturday with crazy traffic, because now everyone's driving. I mean, the train stations out here on Long Island are like empty because everyone's driving in. So I don't want to have to like fight traffic like crazy on a Saturday morning. But that's my problem, not everybody else's. Now, on a personal level, what are some conservation concerns that, like, you personally think are really in need of attention, but might not necessarily be getting the attention that they need?
I mean, a lot of the attention as far as conservation goes, you know, obviously there's habitat destruction, deforestation. But one of the main things that people don't talk about is just make sure you buy from a sustainable source, you know, such as Waikiri, Understory Enterprises, and of course Tesoros. You know, those are three of the main organizations that are breeding dart frogs, each from different country. Waikiri from Ecuador, Tesoros from Colombia, and Understory from Peru. You know, so, you know, I mean, there's plenty of frogs out there, to be honest with you. So there's really no reason at this point for people to be buying smuggled frogs. You know, and it's just adding on to the cost as far as, like, you know, you're buying an animal that you don't know how old it is and what disease is bringing in and things like that. So definitely buy captive bred, you know, support these organizations that are, you know, put their efforts into it, and, you know, and they've been doing it for quite a while. So definitely try to buy from sustainable source. I know it's a little more expensive than, you know, buying a wild caught frogs, and that's probably what draws people to buy wild caught frogs, you know, because they're cheaper. But again, that comes with a price.
No, that's definitely true. I mean, you do get what you pay for, and I think that a lot of beginners kind of end up having a bad experience because they're buying that wild caught frog. So, I mean, I had a bad experience with a wild caught pumilio, and it kind of turned me off to them for a while. But I mean, realistically, what happened was it was an import, did not acclimate well to captivity, probably came in with some parasites, and it just, I mean, on a personal level, I know that that turned me off to them. So you can imagine someone coming into the hobby and saying, all right, well, you get someone who's a beginner at an expo. Hey, I got $35-$40. I'm going to buy, you know, I'm going to buy a Blue Jeans. And then it might not, you might end up putting more money into deworming and all this other, you know, any kind of veterinary care, anything like that. Whereas if you got a quality frog that was captive bred under the right circumstances, you'd end up with a much better experience, even though you laid out a little bit more money to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, one of the things we kind of talked about off air was Lamani. Now, I know that you kind of wanted to talk about their situation in the hobby and sort of what's going on towards taking care of their preservation.
Yeah, so Tesoros is actually working on a reintroduction program. They just actually got the permits, where they got the permits to release Red Lamani back into the wild. They were just waiting on this whole COVID thing to kind of die down a little bit. And they're also looking to see if there's any way that they can actually track the frogs in the forest, you know, or in case anybody does smuggle them out, maybe they can put a transponder in them, you know, that can be scanned and things like that, so they can actually know that, you know, it was a smuggled frog that was taken from the forest. Red Lamani are probably one of the most critically endangered animals, amphibians in the world, just simply because of their coloration. And it's considered to be, like, you know, the frog, you know, in the hobby, aside from koi, the koi morph sylvatica. You know, it was always a Red Lamani that was, like, always a sought-after frog. Back in the 90s, I mean, Red Lamanis were coming in by the hundreds, you know. And the last time I saw Red Lamani for sale were actually, aside from Tesoro, was actually in 2000. And that was through the American Zoo Association, and they were asking $5,000 for a pair.
Wow. You know? That's crazy.
Yeah. So it just goes to show you it's been insane. I think that was the last pair that was ever imported, actually. And, you know, but none of those frogs that ever left Colombia came out legally anyway until Tesoros came about. It's always been, you know, they were always smuggled in fish shipments, you know. So it's interesting, and you know, Tesoros is working on they've been working on the release of Red Lamani for quite a while, and you know, it took them about 8 years for them to get permits for, you know, because when it comes to releasing animals back into the wild, it's always a lot of bureaucracy and red tape you have to jump through in order for them to do that. And they actually work with the communities down in where Red Lamani habitat is, and you know, they work with the local kids there, that the local kids make t-shirts and stuff like that and different art artifacts, and Tesoros actually sells them at Frog Day, and all the profits from those proceeds actually go back to the kids in the community there, you know. So they're getting the community involved to try and preserve the habitat and preserve the animals as well.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important that people realize that there are places out there that sort of serve the dual purpose of supplying the hobby with healthy captive bred frogs, but also at the same time, they give back to the source, meaning you're engaging local communities to work towards a sustainable operation, and you're giving them something back. So it's much easier to, you know, provide someone with... what's the word I'm looking for? It's better having a good relationship that's going to be sustainable, where local people are getting money back into their communities by doing things in a way that's only going to be productive, rather than just pulling species, you know, individuals out of the wild and then selling them off and having them exported. I mean, two reasons. Number one, the species is going to be gone. And second, they're going to ultimately lose that source of income once they're all gone. So by creating a sustainable environment, it's much easier to accommodate the hobby's needs, but at the same time also serve the needs of the people who actually live there with these animals and provide them with habitat that they can continue to survive.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I went to go and try and find Red Lamani in the wild. And I mean, we ended up going on a wild goose chase all day long, basically, because, you know, there were three populations where the guy knew that were there. So the first one we went to, you know, we literally get out of the car And so they chop down the entire forest and they build a town there, basically. You know, he said, you know, when we got there, he was just like, wow, this is devastating. You know, he says he was there 2 years prior to that and he found about 30 frogs in just a half an hour. And then so he was like, all right, let's try this other place, where he knew. So we kind of go over there, you know, and there's about 10 feet of forest in front and the rest of it behind it was all chopped down. And we're walking up the hill and he's like, you guys hang out here. Let me go check to see if anybody's at this house. So, you know, as he's walking up there, then before he gets to the house, he actually turns back and gets to us. He's like, all right, let's go back. There's landmines here.
Wow. So, wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of
a good time.
I mean, yeah, that's pretty intense.
Yeah. And then the third, you know, spot that we went to try and find him where, you know, he went up pretty high up in the mountain and then he was able to see a pair, but he wasn't able to catch it for us to photograph. And I was able to hear a male calling it, but I was not able to locate it. You know, but he said that was a spot where, you know, he also found the population used to be pretty big there and it, you know, it was just decimated. And another thing that happened was there was a national park, which was actually guarded, you know, with guards. And when Tesoros announced that they had their permits to export Red Lamani, there was about 300 maybe frogs in there. And, you know, some European guy actually paid some people to go into the park at night and smuggle 300 frogs.
Yikes.
300 Red Lamanis out there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so that population took a while to rebound as well. So
now, I mean, what makes them so special? I mean, is it their range is just small and they're more susceptible to over collecting, or is it just, I mean, what makes them unique as opposed to other species?
I mean, it's a red and black frog with, you know, white toenails.
Gotcha.
So I think just the color red is just very attractive to people. You know, it's one of those frogs that you really only see, you know, before you would only see in pictures, you know. That was a frog I thought I never owned, you know, to be honest with you, until Tesoros came along and, you know, I was able to own, you know, I own a pair and several other juveniles now. But, you know, it's just one of those frogs that, you know, people want what they can't get. And that's
yeah,
the problem.
It's like the Holy Grail. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, and this is just an observation, this doesn't obviously apply to everybody, but a new locale will come out, and let's not get into species or whatever, but a new locale will come out, you know, it'll be differently colored, and everyone's going to say, that shouldn't be here. But meanwhile, they're like biting at the bit to get it themselves. So
it's,
I mean, what, you've kept them in captivity. What's their captive care like?
I mean, they're definitely a more sensitive frog than the rest of the larger phagas, I find. They also don't reproduce as frequently or as easily as the other larger phagas. So that's probably why their population is taking a toll to bounce back. I mean, taking a while to bounce back. So, I mean, they're just a finicky frog. It's not a frog that I would recommend for anybody to keep, especially those that don't have experience keeping frogs. You know, it's a reason why it's a Holy Grail frog, you know. It's just very difficult to keep.
Yeah, and again, it also, you know, they obviously, you know, ones that are legal obviously command a pretty hefty price tag. I mean, like you said earlier, I mean, some of the large obligates, like when I went to American Frog, I think it was, when was the last one in Staten Island? I think it was 2014?
I think it might have been a little, no, I think it was probably, let's see, last year was 19, 18, 17, I think was the last one in Staten Island.
That sounds about right, because it was always on a Sunday. And at my old job, I used to work Sundays. So I only made it to that one because I ended up taking a vacation day. But just the large obligates, I mean, the price tag that some of them had was very, very high. I mean, I had on an earlier show, I had a conversation with, you know, with Troy Goldberg about, you know, some of the care and the large obligates and why they're so expensive. And, you know, just like you said, they don't produce a lot of offspring, and it's there's a lot of caveats to their care, and they're just a lot more sensitive than other species.
Yeah. And because now Tesoros is able to export them pretty much pretty easily now. You know, I handle the imports for Tesoros into, you know, the Northeast here on the East Coast. And pretty much we only do that twice a year. And, you know, but it's a lot of stress, you know, as far as like making sure all the paperwork is correct. You know, stressful picking them up. They have to go through inspections with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. There's a custom inspection. So it's not as easy as just saying, hey, send the frogs and that's it. You know, I go pick them up at the airport. There's a lot that goes into, you know, in a frog import that people don't realize. So just like, usually like once the import date is set, then Tesoros has to get permits just to transport the frogs from their facilities to the airport, and then they have to get permit for, you know, they have to get a permit for count of the frogs, and then I have to, you know, start filing paperwork here, all the CITES paperwork. I usually start doing that about a week prior, and then I got to notify U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you know, usually about 3 days prior, to let them know that, you know, the frogs are coming in and make sure they're going to have somebody available to inspect the frogs, you know, and things like that. So
yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. I don't think that, you know, the average person realizes is that there's a lot of, I mean, to do this the right way, there is a lot of, you know, legal hurdles that you have to go through. And, you know, the best thing for this type of hobby is to do it, you know, do it the right way. Because if you're doing it the right way, then there's not going to be recourse. Because when you have irresponsible parties come into, and this really applies to any hobby. I mean, you could get into it, say, with just like, for example, like dogfighting. You know, there's going to be people that engage in this activity that's wrong. And ultimately what it ends up doing is anybody who has pits is going to kind of suffer for that. You know what I'm saying with the analogies? So if you have people that are getting in trouble for doing it illegally, then everyone gets punished for it. And that's not something that I think anybody wants. So it's just another reason to champion the cause of, you know, captive care and doing everything legit.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, besides dart frogs, maybe I'm just kind of biased because I mostly keep dart frogs, but besides dart frogs like Lamani and, you know, some of the other species, what about non-dart frog species like tree frogs? I mean, I know we've got some concerns with the glass frog and the lemur leaf frogs. I mean, is there anything that you want to talk about in terms of them? Or
yeah, so I mean, the lemur leaf frogs, tree frogs, you know, the majority of them that are in the hobby now actually came from the Costa Rican Amphibian Research Center. So they were, you know, they were able to export quite a few to Understory Enterprises, and then Understory was able to distribute them into the hobby from there. They've bred quite a lot now that I actually saw some for sale yesterday for about $50. So they're fairly common now in the hobby. I know Brian Kubicki down in the Costa Rican Amphibian Research Center has been doing a lot of in situ conservation with them. So their population has bounced back quite a little bit, but they're still on the endangered list. The other one would be the yellow eye tree frogs, the Agalocanus ani, which actually hasn't been seen in the hobby for quite a while now. I used to have a group, and then when I moved, you know, unfortunately I lost them. They just didn't take the move very well. They basically look like red eye tree frogs, except they're yellow, you know. They have yellow eyes instead of red. So, I mean, but that's a frog that's really, you know, on the brink of extinction there. You also have the Montella Kawani from Madagascar, who were completely, the populations were very decimated for the hobby, you know, back in the late 90s and early 2000s. They were coming in by the hundreds and thousands, you know. And those were frogs that, you know, don't breed very well. The majority of people don't know, really know how to keep them because they've never been to their habitat. I got the chance to go there, go see them in the wild last year. And it's a very cool habitat. It's only, max temperature is like 70 degrees, and so, and that's during summer. So in the winter, they drop pretty cold at night. So they need that drop in order to be able to reproduce. So, as far as glass frogs, there's a lot of glass frogs that are still being discovered. Unfortunately, glass frogs are not on CITES. So that's the only downfall to that.
I read the news article about that. There was a discussion. They ended up, I don't know if the whole thing was just tabled or if it was just completely killed, but that was kind of a contentious issue. Yeah, they didn't make it to CITES. That happened like this year, didn't it?
Well, they were trying to get them on CITES this year. They've never been on CITES. That's a problem. So, and there are new species being discovered year after year. There are quite a few discovered in Ecuador in the last few years there. So, glass frogs, I guess the majority of people just never started going out into the forest at night, up until, maybe like 20 years ago, I would say. If you ever get a chance to go out in the forest at night, it's a totally different world than it is during the day. The amount of insects that you see, and it's just unbelievable. You get to see snakes, and of course, a whole lot of tree frogs, different tree frogs that come out. So it's an amazing experience to be out at night in the forest. Colombia right now, as far as, with the ceasefire and stuff like that. Like there's a lot to be discovered there, especially as far as tree frogs and glass frogs. There's gonna be a whole lot there that just hasn't nobody's been able to venture out into the forest really at night just because of that. It just wasn't safe enough to go out there, but I would guess in the next 5, 6 years as it gets safer, there'll definitely be, a lot more stuff being discovered.
Yeah, it's amazing the speed at which new species are being discovered, but the fact that people don't necessarily realize that in the mainstream media. So someone discovers a small brown frog in a rainforest somewhere, and it doesn't make the news. And unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily do justice to the cause, because it doesn't get the same attention as, I mean, black rhinoceros going extinct is a huge deal, but it's still a blip. You know what I mean?
So Santiago Ron, who works for the Jumbatu Center down in Ecuador, which is associated with Huayquirri. So a few years ago, he discovered a new tree frog, and so he didn't know what to name it, so he named it after Prince Charles. So because he named it after Prince Charles, the frog got a lot of attention. And he was
Understood.
even, yeah, he even got invited over to the castle in England and met the royal family and everything.
That's
Believe
really
it or not.
funny. You know, that's funny that you mentioned that, because in the tarantula world, there was, I believe it was the Afonopelma genus, and it was discovered. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was somewhere in Nevada, and the scientific name of it was, the genus was Afonopelma, and the species name was Johnny Cashii, because it was named after Johnny Cash. So that made it to, not front page news, but that made it newsworthy, just because of the name. That's really funny. I guess if you want a species to do well, you discover it, you got to give it a really, really good name.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, what's it like being in all these places at night and observing all these species? Because I mean, most of us look, I mean, most of them are just kind of like armchair naturalists, I mean, I've never been out into, I mean, I went to Puerto Rico once when I was a kid, but we didn't get out. We got into the rainforest, but not out into into the thick of it, like at night when a lot of species were active. I mean, what's that experience like?
I mean, it's great. I mean, you hear a lot of different calling, lots of different calls. There's even some mammals that are only nocturnal that you would see at night as well. Depending on where you go, like in Costa Rica, you'll see a kinkajou at night, things like that. And you might see an anteater as well. You know, so it's not just, you know, just frogs and, you know, and reptiles. So, you know, there's a whole lot of things that you could be missing out on that you would only see at night. You know, so like most of the crocodilians also, it'll be easier to spot at night because you can just shine a flashlight by any waterway and, you know, you'll see the shine right back at you. Last year in February, my wife and I took a trip over to Mexico, and you know, there was like on the hotel grounds that we were staying at was kind of also like a nature preserve, and there was a restaurant that was by the water, and then I said to her, there's eyes shining by the water there.
Really? It's great.
There's a crocodilian there. And she's like, no, there isn't. You're crazy. So then the next day we took a kayak trip down, you know, that was like a guided kayak trip down the river with a guide. And the guy said, yeah, there's four crocodiles on the property. So he went and we were able to find one that was sleeping on the bank. And I said to her, you see, and you thought I was crazy.
That's really funny.
So, which species, you know, was it American crocodile or was it like a Cuban crocodile?
Yeah, it was
or?
American crocodile.
Okay. I saw one once in the Keys, just for like a split second. We were diving down that high. I think it was, what's the name of that highway? I think it's like one. It's like the one road that goes through the Keys all the way.
One.
Yeah. I saw it like, maybe like, it wasn't huge, maybe like 6 foot. And it just took off like right into the water. And I was like, I said to my wife, did you see that? She goes, what? And I was like, oh, it's gone. So, I mean, do you think that ecotourism is ultimately good for conservation, like people going to these places and really kind of immersing themselves in these environments? Like, is that, do you think that that's kind of like a good resource for conservation?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at Costa Rica. Costa Rica is a prime example of ecotourism. I mean, that's their majority of their economy. I mean, that's pretty much what they're known for. They got rid of all the zoos a few years ago, so they no longer have any zoo in Costa Rica. Everything is out in nature. They have the most national parks by any country pretty much in the world. So everywhere you go, it's just like, you know, you see a group of people that are on a bird tour or, you know, on some other type of tour, either rafting or a combination of both. But, you know, Costa Rica is that example country where ecotourism just, you know, you can see, they see the gold mine in ecotourism, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't like Belize is sort of similar, right? They have a lot of ecotourism too?
I'm not too familiar with Belize. I do know they have some ecotourism. I'm not sure how, you know, how big it is down there, you know, but I do know that they do have some as well.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, put you on the spot.
No worries.
Now, obviously, you know, one of the things that I kind of like to address on this show is the role that hobbyists have in conservation. I mean, what do you think the role of hobbyists is in the conservation of endangered frog species? I mean, amphibian species in general. I mean, what do you think could be done to improve it?
The main thing is to share information. You know, nowadays, obviously, with social media, sharing information has become a lot easier. So, I mean, the hobby has come a long way from what it used to be back in the early 90s to what it is today. You know, nutrition is a lot better now. You know, the accessibility of food, different types of food, you know. So there's even housing, cages are a lot easier now. So there's a bunch of stuff that's changed, lighting, you know, everything in terms of habitat setup, how to keep your animals is completely different now than what it used to be. And it's so much easier too. So, the one thing I do find is that, you know, lately though, a lot of people, like, I try not to comment as much on Facebook or, you know, in Instagram anymore, just simply because there's a lot of people nowadays that don't take advice from, you know, a lot of the people that have been in the hobby for quite a long time.
No, really? You serious?
Yeah. So, You know, they think they read something online and they're already an expert. So, you know, I just kind of stay away from that, you know, that whole thing now.
I agree with you. I think that that's something that kind of permeates everything, though. I mean, I don't purport to be an expert on everything. And, you know, every guest I have on this show, I always learn something from. Because, look, I've been keeping frogs for what I like to think is a long time. But there are people like you're people who are way more experienced than I am. So I'm not going to give someone advice unless I know that it's proven and it's reliable information.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And there's going to be different things that are going to be conducive towards, you know, the way you're keeping them as far as like, you know, to your environment versus other people. So there's going to be, there's several ways to keep, you know, the same animal. So it's not just going to be, you know, I keep them the best way and that's that, you know?
So. Yeah. I mean, I think that, I guess some people I've heard, and this is obviously just an opinion, but I know some people feel that if you can get a species to reproduce successfully, then you're doing something right with its husbandry, especially with amphibians, because there's so many specifics to getting them to reproduce successfully as opposed to, I'm probably going to bury myself, but I mean, you can get two dogs to reproduce fairly easily, you know, getting like a couple of obligates to reproduce successfully is a lot more difficult. And I think that, you know, with advances and, like you said, sharing information with people, that has become easier, but there's not necessarily one single way to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what was it? I totally forgot what I was going to say, and I never do that. where do you see amphibian populations going in the future? I mean, now that I feel like, you know, it's... You got a moving truck. That's extinction. You know, the decline of species across the globe, that's a moving truck. And you can't just stop that dead on a dime. You have to put the brakes on first and slow it down. I mean, where do you see amphibian populations going in the future? I mean, you've kind of seen the decline. I mean, do you think that there's going to be improvement in the near future?
I certainly hope so. I mean, the sad part is with the whole seas war and down in Colombia, you know, and the forest being safer. Now there's people claiming territory, and there's actually more deforestation going on there than before when the war was going on. So that's the sad part of it. The good part is that it seems like the younger generation is actually more, you know, climate inclined into conservation and preserving the earth. What I've seen over the past couple of years, you know, when it comes to climate marches and stuff like that, it seems like there's a lot more youth involved. And in terms of the people that I've met, there's a lot more kids that are really into conservation, and hopefully it continues to go that way. You know, it would certainly be sad, you know, to only be able to see these animals in captivity and not be able to see them out in the wild.
Yeah, I mean, I do have some younger listeners, and it is encouraging to know that the attitude towards younger people through, I mean, I guess a lot of that education kind of started, I mean, you and I are kind of close in age, but I think a lot of that started earlier on, like in the early 80s and mid 80s, that understanding that you have to take an actual effort if you want things to improve. And I'm hoping that over time that that's kind of magnified, because I personally like to impress a lot of conservation issues on my kids, but I also have to explain to them that we live differently than other people. Not everybody has a basement full of frogs, but when they have friends come over, I always try to put it into some sort of a context that, you know, reinforces the importance of conservation. But I mean, one thing that you touched on earlier was, in South America, where you employ local people to, you know, take an active role in conservation, and how a lot of that money comes back and it ends up going back to the kids. I think that that's a really good thing too, because if you can impress upon local people at that level the value of conservation, that's going to just continue to translate into, you know, into better outcomes later on as they grow up.
So let me give you a really prime example. So I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with the picture of the koi sylvatica that I took in the wild. So that particular frog has an interesting story behind it. So that frog, the only reason, the main objective of that frog was to go see koi in the wild. A koi are found on a reserve, you know, which is actually a pro-avis reserve that, you know, that's for bird watching and bird conservation. Unfortunately, they don't work with the local community there. So we were not able to get into the reserve to see those frogs. That frog was meant to be smuggled into Europe. There was a European that came down and placed an order with a guy who owned the property of where we found that frog. And the guy caught 10 of them. He had them in a bucket, you know, for 2 weeks. He said the guy never showed up, so he released them into a different habitat. So that was the only way we really saw that frog. So we were lucky to see that frog. But the unfortunate side of it is he intended to sell that frog, and at a cost that was just really shocking, and it was only for $1.50.
Wow. Now, man.
And since that trip, you know, the guy that took us to his property actually got him to stop smuggling frogs by creating, you know, little trinkets and stuff like that, you know, to sell in town to the tourists that he brings there for conservation and things like that. So he's a, you know, there's a catch-22 where these frogs are, you know, which is in Panama as well, is the same thing. You got to realize, if you ever go down there and actually see what's going on, is that these people have no economy where they live. So they need a way to feed their families, you know, and, you know, they live off the land, they hunt off the land. But, you know, if the animals aren't there, you know, they're sometimes they go without food, you know, so they need a way to kind of, you know, so there is a catch-22 there as far as, you know, I understand the reason why he did it. I don't agree with it, you know. So, but let's find a different solution in a way that we can make this work for both of us and keep the animals there, you know, where they would have more value in nature than, you know, than being smuggled out.
I definitely agree with you. I think that there's a very important human dynamic in all of this. And it's very easy for people to think that, well, you know, a local population, and this could be in any part of the globe, it doesn't really matter where. A local population, people will say, well, they're exploiting them, they're ripping them out of the wild. And so, well, the thing is, a lot of these populations, they don't necessarily, I mean, they really don't have the resources to be able, like you said, like to feed themselves. It's an important part of their economy. But if you can, like you said, change that in such a way that instead of pulling frogs out of the wild, creating areas where ecotourism can happen, or they're, like you said, they're, you know, they're making artistic representations of frogs and they're selling those. Anything that you can get people to change their mind. But, you know, people have to be able to exist. People have to be able to eat. They have to be able to take care of their families. You know, once you have these needs that have been met, it's so much easier to influence people to go in another direction.
Yeah. And the same thing happens in Panama. Like in Panama, they were, you know, like I went to an eco resort, you know, I've been to an eco resort there, and the lady was telling me, you know, who owned the property at the time, she said to me, you know, she would tell me, yeah, I mean, I understand it. I know some of the people that are catching the frogs to sell, you know, to the smugglers and to the, you know, into the so-called frog farm at the time. They're paying these people $1 per frog, you know, per pamilio, to bring to them to exports for, you know, 100 times more. So, you know, it's such a situation where, you know, where it is, but, you know, there has to be a way, like, you know, where it can work for both. You know, there needs to be an actual farm established in Panama, you know, instead of just pulling frogs out of the wild. And El Tesoros was working on getting that done, but, you know, unfortunately they haven't, you know, gotten anything from the government. Panamanian government just hasn't given them the green light to be able to do that. So, and they keep saying that there's somebody else ahead of them. So, you know, as far as Tesoros being able to do that, they're not going to be able to do that, but who knows if the person in front of them is going to be able to do that, you know, to set up an actual captive bred frog farm for pimelios down there. And supposedly we were talking to the CITES committee last week to about possibly setting up a frog farm in Brazil. And supposedly they issued 3 permits to 3 different people, which we're trying to find out who these people are. Because they won't release that information as far as, you know. So the CITES committee said they issued 3 permits for Brazil for someone to start a farm, establish a frog farm down there, you know, with dart frogs. And so we'll see how that goes. Hopefully in the future they'll be able to get, you know, captive bred, you know, galax out and other frog species as well that'll be legal. Because right now, any frog coming out of Brazil, any Brazilian origin, it's not legal in the hobby.
Yeah, that's just to anybody who also lives outside of the United States, that has to do with the Lacey Act. And in other countries, they don't have that. So it's, I guess you could say the legislation is stricter here, almost like, almost as an unintended consequence. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but the Lacey Act was originally to prevent the transport of endangered species between states. So, meaning you couldn't take something from Arizona and bring it to New Mexico or from, you know, Pennsylvania to Ohio. You couldn't take that species across state lines. So the Lacey Act serves that purpose of basically enforcing the laws of other countries as it affects us, meaning, just like you said, nothing. Brazil has never officially legally exported anything. So I don't want to get into the whole Brazil debacle, but it will be interesting to see how that unfolds in the near future.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, just, you know, I guess the conservation is always such a serious topic. I was having a conversation with Mark Mandica of the Amphibian Foundation, and like by the time we got to the end of our discussion, we were talking about Tuffy, the last Rabs's fringe-limbed tree frog. And by the end, I was like, Mark, I'm sad now, you know? Like, this is like, it's conservation can be so depressing. And it'd be really nice if it actually does turn a corner and we can actually have discussions to say, like, well, you know, we've accomplished so much now, we can at least have more of a positive attitude. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a pessimist. But just to lighten it up a little bit, I mean, what's your favorite species? Like, what species really intrigues you and just is like your kind of go-to, I guess you would say?
Be honest with you, I don't have a favorite species so far.
Damn.
I would say this Koi sylvatica would probably be, you know, at the top of the list. You know, and there's a few others that I've seen pictures that I'm not allowed to talk about, and it's really just, I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming into the hobby, let's just say, that hasn't been made public yet. So there's different frogs from different organizations that have been discovered, you know, in Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, different morphs that are still not in the hobby yet. Some in Venezuela. You know, these are just frogs that I've seen pictures of. I haven't seen them in person yet. You know, and hopefully they make it into the hobby someday, you know, and it'll be, I mean, the amount of variation that is still out there to be discovered is just mind blowing, to be honest with you, especially from the pictures I've seen. So some of the stuff from Peru and, you know, some of the stuff from Venezuela, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, but unfortunately, I wish I could share those pictures and share, you know,
I don't want to know. Don't want to know. You know, that will, I'm sure, will unfold and come out, you know, with time. You know, obviously, you know, it's a contentious, it's a whole big disaster, if you could see it that way. No, actually, it's not a disaster, but you know, on this show, I always want to just encourage everybody. Look, you know, we always want to support legal and sustainable methods of getting things into the hobby, and I know that it can be kind of dicey getting to that end. So we'll just leave it at that, but I'm sure it's going to be very, very interesting to see what does unfold in the hobby, you know, within the next few years.
Yeah. And I think what happens is a lot of people don't understand the efforts that go into these conservation projects. Understory Enterprises, I was fortunate enough to take a trip with them about 10 years ago, you know, and the amount of searching that you have to do for a frog, just to find one frog, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot of effort. You know, and Mark Pepper will tell you there were times when they were out in the forest for 2 weeks before they would see one frog or a particular morph. So, you know, we're lucky that we have Understory. We're lucky that we have Waikiri. You know, we're lucky that we have Tesoros, you know, and the Costa Rican Amphibian Research Center, and now the Amphibian Foundation as well. So, you know, those are great organizations that really should be supported. You know, because without them, really, it would be kind of hard to, you know, be able to get a lot of these morphs into the hobby.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also worth mentioning that these are all organizations that not only work towards conservation, but they also advocate on behalf of the hobby. So,
yeah. So what happened, you know, Understory owns, you know, they buy property down in Peru to turn it into preservation as well. They own a good amount of land and close to Chizuda, where they're able, you know, they have it as a, you know, as a preserve just for, you know, the frogs there. You know, I know Waikiri is working on doing the same thing, on buying some land just for conservation efforts. Tesoro is working on doing the same thing. The Costa Rican Amphibian Research Center, it's actually, they own a reserve, you know, their lodge is on a reserve. If you guys get a chance to go to Costa Rica, touch base with Brian Kubicki, you know, he can guide you around, you know, and show you guys, you know, you can stay at his place. He has a lodge there as well for tourists. So, you know, it's a great place to go.
Yeah, I was on their website, actually. They have two pieces of property, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was on their website, and I'd like to get him on the show sometime. I was just, some of the modifications they made, like digging ponds and creating breeding sites and whatnot. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of his institute conservation. And since he started doing that, obviously the populations have started growing. So it's been great to see.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, before we wrap up, I mean, do you have any final thoughts or anything else that you want to share before we kind of wind down?
I mean, if you get a chance to go out in the wild and see frogs in the wild, by all means do so. I know it's going to be hard to just like have a family trip and make it frog oriented.
I find ways. I always find ways.
But Costa Rica and Panama are good ways to start, where you can take your family on vacation and be like, hey, look, let's go on a nature walk. And, you know, but it'll be enjoyable for kids as well, because, you know, they'll see monkeys and other stuff, other birds, toucans and stuff like that on the hike. So you can have short hikes there and, you know, and then head to the beach after, you know, just make sure you buy it sustainable from sustainable farms, you know, frog organizations. You can check out pictures of frogs from the wild and from my collection on my Facebook page, which is froghub.com. I mean, not froghub.com, which is on Facebook, actually just froghub. Or you can check out my Instagram account, which is darkfrogs, and you'll see pictures of, you know, some of the stuff in the wild. And like I said, a lot of stuff from, you know, from my collection as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, listen, Julio, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Learned a lot. I think that definitely got a lot of insight in terms of what goes on sort of like behind the public eye, you know, the amount of work that's really being done to establish healthy populations of captive bred animals in the hobby, and at the same time working to preserve the natural habitat so that they're not lost in the wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me.
No, it was my pleasure. My pleasure. All right, everyone, I want to thank you again for tuning in. And I hope to see you guys again soon. Why do I always say that? I'm not going to see anyone. I'm going to hear you. All right. Anyway, it's been fun. Julio Rodriguez, thanks a lot, everyone. Take care.
Thanks.